Syrian President Bashar al-Assad takes the oath of office following his re-election in the country's presidential vote in May. At least 160 people are confirmed dead in flooding in Germany and Belgium. The numbers are feared to rise as hundreds are still missing. And India reports more than 38,000 new coronavirus cases and 560 deaths. Hello and welcome from Tehran. You're tuned to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story takes us to Syria this hour, where Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has been sworn in for another seven-year term after winning the May election. Assad took the oath of office for the fourth time during an official ceremony at the presidential palace in Damascus. In an address, Assad hailed the Syrian people for their resistance against the enemy's plots. He said Syria would not be divided, adding that all bargains against his country have failed. The Syrian president also appreciated Iran and Russia's support for freeing his country from the terrorists. He called it his priority to free parts of Syria that are still in the hands of the terrorists backed by Turkey and the United States. Assad won the presidency election by a landslide, securing more than 95% of the vote. Well, this was his second victory since foreign-backed insurgency engulfed the Arab country in 2011. Meanwhile, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has taken the oath of office for the fourth time after winning the May election a short while ago. We were joined by our correspondent, Muhammad Ali, who updated us on the official ceremony.
He also highlighted the importance of the next period in the Islamic sector in Syria. He said that work will be focused on renewable energy and investment in the country. As you know, we are in a very difficult situation, in Syria, economic situation, in light of the destruction that happened by foreign-backed terrorism, also in light of the economic sanctions by the United States and the West, those sanctions that have made the Syrian daily lives much more difficult and made it almost impossible for the Syrian government to import the basic needs for the Syrians every day. So definitely the most important priority for the Syrians and for the Syrian president and for the government currently will be the economic situation. He was focusing on the agricultural sector, on the industrial sector, on reopening all of the factories that were affected by the war in various parts of the country. So all the focus will be now on inside Syria, not on the outside like before the war. The agricultural sector, the investment sector, he will also be giving investments, definitely will be getting investments for its allies that sit with it, for example, Iran, Russia, and China.
Meanwhile, representatives of the Afghan government and the Taliban have launched fresh peace talks in the Qatari capital of Doha. Several high-ranking officials, including former President Hamid Karzai and the head of the High Council for National Reconciliation, Abdullah Abdullah, are attending the negotiations. The spokesman for the government's negotiating team said Kabul expects the negotiators to make headway with the talks in a short time and to reach a conclusion. He expressed hope the talks will lead to a lasting peace in the country. Well, the negotiations come as the Taliban militants have stepped up their attacks on cities and villages and have captured a vast swath of territory. Now, the Afghan military has been engaged in fierce fighting with the militants in some areas to try to retake control of those regions, including a southern border crossing with Pakistan. Well, as the U.S. Army is preparing to leave Afghanistan after 20 years of occupation, former National Security Advisor John Bolton says American troops are walking away victoriously. But the internet does not seem convinced by his claims. Up next, hashtag trending brings you some of those reactions shared on social media.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another hashtag trending with me, Ali Reza. The U.S. Army is finally about to leave Afghanistan after two decades of occupation. Now, oftentimes when your war drags on for 20 years, it invariably means that you are lost. But some will just never learn from their past mistakes. former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton insists that the Americans were not defeated in Afghanistan, but merely lost patience. Now, we've all heard the same thing being said about the Vietnam War, too, walking away. Sir, walking away means you lost. Bolton's comments by no means indicate his approval for the full withdrawal of the U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Quite the contrary. In fact, he believes that the U.S. troops should remain there indefinitely. In other words, he believes in endless war. All right, now let's see how the internet has reacted to this. Our first comment comes from Ole and Kare. They wrote, "Walked away or slinked away amounts to the same thing, an ignominious defeat by a sandals-wearing, little-equipped enemy with more hearts and greater purpose. In fact, the U.S. has won not even one of the several dozen wars it started around the world since 1945. Our next comment is by Erlin. They wrote, "Walked away as in Vietnam because the war was not going to be won. Well, memorized the lesson of lying. Walked away equals loss." Their next comment comes from Ashraf. They wrote, "Dislike this warmonger Israeli Bolton. U.S. occupied Afghanistan for 20 years, did whatever they liked, killed innocents in the middle of night, bombed hospitals, etc. Yes, there was resistance, but the fact is America killed thousands and occupied and could have stayed even more. And now they are walking away without any accountability. Now, this might mean an end to war for the U.S., but what happens to the Afghan civilians who were harmed by decades of conflict, whose rights are being violated to this day? Anyhow, let's check out some more comments on websites. The first one comes from Positron. They wrote, "The case of Afghanistan was not a war. It was an occupation 20 years ago when the U.S. killed Taliban and the war ended. The rest of the case was an occupation. No matter what a retarded, from the beginning expired official like Bolton trying to twist, convolute, and misrepresent the case, the U.S., other than destroying the country, didn't accomplish anything." The next comment comes from Defender. They wrote, "You know why they didn't lose the war? Because the Taliban militants they created, armed, and trained are taking over." The next one comes from Exceptional Losers. 20 years and the devastation, the devastating exceptional superpower can't defeat Taliban? Where does the Taliban get its weapons from? USA has walked away in defeat every time. Only when they dropped terrorist weapons of mass destruction and caught adversaries off guard, they won. You can't drop weapons of mass destruction and win ever again. U.S. military should know this. The next comment comes from Hitler was bad. If the world has a just, functional global authority, the USA should be paying money to Libya, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, Lebanon, Syria, Sudan, Cuba, Venezuela, etc. for crimes against humanity. But unfortunately, the UN is a crime against humanity as well. The UN is a product of the Zionist world order. And that calls for even more concentrated efforts towards peace from Afghanistan's neighbors like Iran and Pakistan. One such right step is the upcoming peace conference in Islamabad. Overall, the focus of the attempts is to bring about a democratic atmosphere where all opinions are represented proportionately. The next comment on Twitter comes from Andrew Eager. They wrote, "U.S. left Afghanistan behind a mess. If you went in 2001 to kick out the Taliban and you're leaving Afghanistan now to the Taliban, what did all the people that died over there die for in the first place? Convince Talibans to hold general elections in the country." The next comment comes from Akram. He wrote, "China, Pakistan, Russia, Iran, Turkey, all friends want peace in the region, but some elements have increased the suffering in the countries. The list includes the United States." The next comment comes from Abu Huzaifa. He wrote, "Main peace deal factors are ceasefire among U.S., Taliban, and Afghan forces, withdrawal of foreign forces, intra-Afghan negotiations, counter-terrorism assurances. Afghanistan cannot solve its problems alone and needs help from Iran and Pakistan." The next one comes from Muhammad Khan. He wrote, "May Allah have mercy on Afghanistan. May peace be established in Afghanistan soon. Amen." And that's going to be it for me in this edition of Hashtag Trending. Until next time, take care and bye-bye.
Continue with more news this hour. Devastating floods in Western Europe have claimed at least 160 lives. Now that number could rise further as rescuers are still searching for hundreds who are missing. Germany is the worst hit country where police say 133 people have died as a result of the disaster. A dam at risk of collapse in the North Rhine-Westphalia has forced the evacuation of thousands of people. Meanwhile, in Belgium, 27 deaths have been confirmed, and the interior minister says another 20 people are missing. The deluge has also submerged homes in Luxembourg and the Netherlands. The cost of damage in Europe's worst floods in decades is estimated at several billion euros. Efforts are being made to restore gas, electricity, and telephone services. Meanwhile, COVID-19 cases are surging in several EU nations, mainly attributed to the highly contagious Delta variant. The development could have major health and economic implications. Jerome Hughes brings us more from Brussels.
Following an easing of restrictions in the EU and UK, coronavirus cases across Western Europe are on a sharp upward curve. The Delta variant, first identified in India and which spreads much more easily, is being blamed.
The world is becoming a village, so people travel, it's hard to contain.
See all the people here, and some people are not that careful, I think, so...
One word for me, go to vaccine.
The vast majority of young adults and children in the EU have not been vaccinated. This is why the virus is moving around so quickly, experts say.
In view of the rapid spread of the highly contagious Delta variant that is raising concerns not only in Europe but also around the globe, it is extremely important to vaccinate, as per national recommendations, as many people in Europe as possible.
Economists say the EU simply cannot afford further lockdowns. Economic forecasts for the 27-nation bloc are positive, but there are a lot of unknowns.
We continue to monitor the situation very closely, and in particular, and obviously, we are monitoring the Delta variant.
The fact that protectionist Donald Trump is no longer in the White House offers some economic hope, senior EU officials are indicating.
In terms of our relationships with the US, we have gone from a winter of discontent to a summer of cooperation.
In several EU nations, including Greece, France and Ireland, young people have staged protests, believing they are being forced by governments to take the jab in order to participate in society. We have been getting some views in Belgium.
I mean, it's good that the protest is there, isn't it?
I feel forced to receive something I don't want to receive.
Be vaccinated or not, so you can't force people to do that.
Health authorities in the EU argue it is important that young people do get vaccinated, claiming they may only develop a mild illness initially with COVID-19, but could ultimately go on to suffer from long COVID, which can have life-changing implications. Campaigners say EU leaders are shooting themselves in the foot by not providing more vaccines to less well-off parts of the world. This could lead to new variants that might be resistant to existing vaccines, they warn. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Well, the number of COVID-19 infections and fatalities continue to rise in the world's second most populous country. India reported over 38,000 new cases on Saturday, bringing the total caseload to over 31 million. Also, 560 new deaths have been logged, pushing the overall fatalities to over 413,000. Kerala and Maharashtra states have reported the highest cases in the country, stoking fears of an incoming third wave. Health officials blame the Delta variant for the ongoing struggle to contain the second wave of the virus. The country's cumulative caseload is on decline. However, in May, India saw record high infections. India has the world's second highest caseload and third largest number of deaths. And now to Iran, which has reported more than 175 new coronavirus deaths, taking the total number of related fatalities to nearly 87,000. Health Ministry officials also reported more than 15,000 new infections in the space of 24 hours. That brings the overall tally to more than 3.5 million. The new Delta variant is blamed for the steep rise in the number of infections and deaths. Authorities have implemented strict restrictions to stem the deadly virus. That includes a ban on businesses providing non-essential services to citizens. The discovery of several mass graves containing the remains of children who attended residential schools in Canada has renewed the debate on the historic mistreatment of Indigenous people in that country. Researchers say the graves found so far are only the tip of the iceberg.
The discovery of an unmarked graveyard at a former residential school run by the Catholic Church in the Canadian province of British Columbia in May, which contained at least 215 human remains, mostly young children, prompted an outpouring of grief and anger and a wider investigation into similar boarding schools that were open from the late 19th century to the mid-1990s. The probes have so far found some 1,100 bodies at the sites of former residential schools in the provinces of British Columbia and Saskatchewan. A Canadian researcher whose works contributed to the uncovering of the first mass grave has said the discoveries so far have barely scratched the surface. The residential school system in Canada was established in 1883 under the country's first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald. The aim was to assimilate Indigenous peoples in Canada and destroy their languages and culture. By the 1920s, attending residential schools had been made mandatory for children aged between 7 and 15.
These have been going on for years. The residential school survivors just basically were ignored. Now today, it seems a shock to some people, but it shouldn't be a shock because this was known that it was the policy in Canada. It was also the policy in the United States. They just pulled these kids out of their homes, and they wanted to indoctrinate them. And that's exactly what they tried to do.
Some 150,000 children were separated from their parents, often under threats of persecution.
And with that brings us to the end of this World News Edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
in the limelight. Both Haiti and Cuba for decades have been subjected to actions and policies from the United States and others, both overt and covert, which have undermined self-determination and economic independence at every conceivable juncture. We now present you an article written by Richard Sadan, a journalist, writer, and television reporter. The piece is titled, U.S. Must Get Its Own House in Order, Quit Meddling in Other Nations' Affairs. Over the last few days, U.S. President Joe Biden and his administration have reiterated statements following purported protests in Cuba and the assassination of the former Haitian president, Jovenel Moïse. Joe Biden's administration has suggested they're ready to offer support and help Haiti, if necessary, in the form of U.S. troops. Meanwhile, the White House has also claimed, incredibly, that the U.S. government stands with the people of Cuba. For anyone with a remote understanding of history, these statements at best represent a government completely out of touch with reality, and at worst, betray a much more nefarious purpose behind the U.S. issuing words of support for both countries. Both Haiti and Cuba for decades have been subjected to actions and policies from the United States, both overt and covert, which have undermined self-determination and economic independence at every conceivable juncture. Outside of the United States, very few believe the notion that troops would be sent to other countries for any other reason than to promote American interests. The people of Cuba have been subjected to a blockade and sanctions by the United States for more than six decades, as well as dealing with multiple attempts over the years to undermine the country on a number of levels. Haiti, too, has continued to be punished and weakened by many nations, including the United States of America, ever since the nation produced perhaps the greatest victory against colonialism in recorded history, following the slave rebellion of 1804, which defeated the strongest forces of empire in the world. Neocolonialism has continued to be a tactic against the country ever since, as a price paid for freedom and in becoming the first nation to completely eradicate slavery. When comparing this record with the many examples of crisis and turmoil within the United States itself, the backward sense of priorities and hypocrisy becomes even clearer. And in an ever-evolving global landscape, the whole world sees it. Recently in New York, serious flooding revealed that the city, which is perhaps one of the richest in the world, has serious and long-standing issues with infrastructure. While the conversation is rightly centered around concerns over climate change, the impact of Storm Elsa revealed the neglect and vulnerability of services upon which millions of ordinary people depend. New York's subways were flooded, resulting in perhaps some of the poorest sections of the working class being presented with a choice of either wading waist-deep into filthy, polluted, and dangerous water, or potentially compromising and jeopardizing their employment or family commitments. While many on the social media expressed sympathy for New Yorkers, others mocked the situation, suggesting that they themselves would never risk walking through littered subway water. But that's the point. Surely no one would take such a decision unless they had next to no choice. In a city which is home to some of the most affluent people and powerful institutions in the world, some of the most marginalized residents seem to have been abandoned to the mercy of extreme conditions that no one should be forced to navigate. Local emergency workers stepped in like heroes, but those too are ordinary people. The scene of the flooding, like everything, had been politicized by some seeking political power. And of course, people would argue that the scenes in New York City are a localized issue. But while the floods and extreme weather have revealed quite literal cracks in America's infrastructure, a plethora of other problems reveal a country deep in crisis and on a number of levels. While, of course, Joe Biden won the presidential election last November, he won it by a narrow margin. The defeat of Donald Trump did not smash the forces that produced him on both the right and the left. His administration's subsequent pandering to unfounded fears about immigration, especially the visit by Vice President Kamala Harris to Guatemala, in which she told potential migrants don't come to the United States, reflects the fact that racism and nationalism is as present as ever in the country. The plague of anti-black racism and policing is arguably getting worse, also symptomatic of white supremacy and deep-seated racism, which will not simply be undone with a few political gestures here and there. And just like in the United Kingdom, the chasm between the richest in society and the poorest is as wide as ever, with some of the richest cities failing to house and safeguard the poorest people. The floods in New York City might be a result of hyper-capitalism and ultimately global capitalism with regards to the environmental crisis. But there are many more symptoms of the underlying cause of the latest catastrophe. So while the US government postures and issues statements about other countries, quite simply, there are a long list of problems at home to work through. Rather than feigning support and so-called statements of solidarity for other countries, often in turmoil in part because of the military adventurism of the United States, the White House, with all of the power it possesses, needs to focus on fixing the never-ending list of problems within its own borders, not least for the sake of its own citizens and its global credibility.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, compassion and forgiveness. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Chapter Al-A'raf of Quran, verse number 199 says, practice forgiveness. It expresses the concept of forgiveness and compassion, which is one of the basic principles of the religion of Islam. When we look at the Islamic history, we can see clearly how Muslims established this important precept of the moral teaching of the Quran in their social life. At every point in their advance, Muslims destroyed unlawful practices and created a free and compassionate environment. In the area of religion, language, and culture, they made it possible for people totally opposite to each other to live under the same roof in freedom and peace, thereby giving those subject to them the advantages of knowledge, wealth, and position. Brothers and sisters, this concept of coexistence and tolerance, it is so essential and important for a believer that when we see the plight of today's world, we sometimes feel that it's gotten to a hopeless point. You know, the white supremacy and then discrimination based on nationality, discrimination based on color, discrimination based on race, all of those problems, right? This is the gift of the modern era that we are facing today. If you look at Muslims, alhamdulillah, throughout the history, we have a bright and luminous history. Look at Palestine, for example, as a case study. The Christians, the Jewish, the Muslims, they all lived there when Muslims were controlling this region and this area. But as soon as the Zionist entity of Israel comes into the picture, look what Palestinians have been going through for over 70 years now. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are talking about compassion and forgiveness. And all, you know, the things that we talked about before the break, they show that the moral teaching offered to humanity by Islam is one that will bring peace, happiness, and justice to the world. The horror that is happening in the world today in the name of Islam is far away from the moral teachings of Quran. It is the work of ignorant, bigoted people, criminals who have nothing to do with religion. Because when we talk about what we discussed before the break, some people come around and say, what about ISIS, right? What about Boko Haram and such organizations and notorious outfits? They're operating in the name of Islam, right? Well, you all have to understand and realize this, dear and respected listeners. The Western imperialist agenda is being executed at the hands of Zionists and Takfiris. This is what we are facing. These organizations, these outfits, so to speak, like ISIS, you know, Daesh and Boko Haram and so on and so forth, you can see it clearly that they're not following Islam. They never have followed Islam. And they're not working for Islam. They don't work under any Islamic leadership, right? When you look at the heinous crimes that they create and the funding and the support that they get from the Western governments, the plot is very obvious for those who want to see. You look at the Zionists, you know, who's funding the Zionists. You look at the Takfiris and these ISIS terrorists, who's funding them, who's supporting them, who's providing them with political immunity. So do you think the West would provide them immunity and provide them with resources because they want to strengthen Islam? That's like a joke. These are the failed projects of the Western imperialist ideology and agenda. So remember that point, and hopefully that clears up your confusion. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
It is hard to avoid the conclusion that the Joe Biden administration's fiscal irresponsibility arises from a cynical political calculation. It evidently proposes to employ the federal budget as a slush fund to distribute benefits to various political constituencies, gambling that the avalanche of new debt will not cause a financial crisis before the 2022 congressional elections. We now present you an article written by David P. Goldman, president of Macro Strategy LLC and senior writer at Law and Liberty. The piece is titled U.S. Fiscal Profligacy and the Impending Crisis. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Massive demand-side stimulus combined with the constraints on the supply side in the form of higher taxes is a sure recipe for inflation and eventual recession. According to the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, the fiscal year 2021 U.S. budget deficit will amount to 15% of America's GDP, or gross domestic product, after the passage of an additional $1.9 trillion in demand stimulus, a proportion that the United States has not seen since the Second World War. It is hard to avoid the conclusion that the Biden administration's fiscal irresponsibility arises from a cynical political calculation. It evidently proposes to employ the federal budget as a slush fund to distribute benefits to various political constituencies, gambling that the avalanche of new debt will not cause a financial crisis before the 2022 congressional elections. The additional $2.3 trillion in so-called infrastructure spending that the Biden administration has proposed consists mainly of handouts to Democratic constituencies. During the 12 months ending in March, the deficit stood at 19% of gross domestic product, or GDP. Even worse, the Federal Reserve absorbed virtually all the increase in outstanding debt on its balance sheet. In the aftermath of the 2009 recession, when the deficit briefly rose to 10% of the gross domestic product GDP, foreigners bought about half of the total new issuance of Treasury debt. During the past 12 months, foreigners have been net sellers of U.S. government debt. The U.S. dollar's role as the world's principal reserve currency is eroding fast, and fiscal irresponsibility of this order threatens to accelerate the dollar's decline. The U.S. Federal Reserve has kept short-term interest rates low by monetizing debt, but long-term Treasury yields have risen by more than a percentage point since last July. Markets know that what can't go on forever won't. At some point, private holders of U.S. Treasury debt will liquidate their holdings, as foreigners have begun to do, and rates will rise sharply. For every percentage point increase in the cost of financing federal debt, the U.S. Treasury will have to pay an additional $250 billion in interest. The United States well may find itself in the position of Italy in 2018, but without the rich members of the European Union to bail it out. The flood of federal spending has had a number of dangerous effects already. The U.S. trade deficit in goods as of February 2021 reached an annualized rate of more than $1 trillion a year, an all-time record. China's exports to the United States over the past 12 months, ending in February, also reached an all-time record. Federal stimulus created demand that the U.S. productive facilities could not meet and produced a massive import boom. According to Philadelphia Federal Reserve survey, input prices to U.S. manufacturers in February rose at the fastest rate since 1973. And the gap between input prices and finished goods prices rose at the fastest rate since 2009. The Producer Price Index, PPI, for final demand rose at an annualized 11% rate during the first quarter of this year. The Consumer Price Index, CPI, shows year-on-year growth of only 1.7%, but that reflects dodgy measurements. For example, the price shelter, which comprises a third of the index, supposedly rose just 1.5% over the year, although home prices rose by as much as 10%. If foreigners are net sellers of U.S. Treasury securities, how is the United States financing an external deficit in the range of $1 trillion a year? The United States has two deficits to finance, the internal budget deficit and the balance of payment deficit, and here we refer to this second deficit. The answer is, according to the Treasury data, by selling stocks to foreigners. According to the Treasury International Capital, or TIC system, foreign investors have been dumping low-yielding U.S. treasuries and corporate bonds during the past year. Foreign investors bought $400 billion of U.S. equities and nearly $500 billion of U.S. agency securities backed by home mortgages during the 12 months through to January, but sold $600 billion of treasuries and $100 billion of corporate bonds. This is a bubble on top of a bubble. The U.S. Federal Reserve buys $4 trillion of Treasury securities and pushes the after-inflation yield below zero. That pushes investors into stocks. Foreigners don't want U.S. Treasuries at negative real yields, but they buy into the stock market, which keeps rising, because the U.S. Federal Reserve is pushing down bond yields and so forth. Today, however, the U.S. Treasury market is the weak link in the financial system, supported only by the central bank's monetization of debt. If the extreme fiscal profligacy of the Biden administration prompts private investors to exit the Treasury market, there will be no safe assets left in dollar financial markets. The knock-on effects would be extremely hard to control. The overwhelming majority of the over-the-counter privately traded derivatives contracts serve as interest rate hedges. Market participants typically pledge treasury securities as collateral for those contracts. According to the Bank for International Settlements, the notional value of such contracts now exceeds $600 trillion. Derivative contracts entail a certain amount of market risk, and banks will enter into them with customers who want to hedge interest rate positions only if the customers put up collateral, like the cash margin on a stock bought on credit. The market value, after netting for matching contracts that cancel each other out, is about $15 trillion. If the prices of Treasury securities fall sharply, the result will be a global margin call in the derivatives market, forcing the liquidation of vast amounts of positions. Something like this occurred between 6th of March and 18th of March 2020, when the yield on inflation-protected U.S. Treasury securities, or TIPS, jumped from about negative 0.6% to positive 0.6% in just 2 weeks. The COVID-19 crash prompted a run on cash at American banks, as U.S. corporate borrowers drew down their credit lines. U.S. banks, in turn, cut credit lines to European and Japanese banks, who were forced to withdraw funding to their customers for currency hedges on holdings of U.S. Treasury securities. The customers, in turn, liquidated U.S. Treasury securities, and the Treasury market crashed. That was the first time that a Treasury market crash coincided with a stock market crash. Instead of acting as a crisis refuge, the U.S. Treasury market became the epicenter of the crisis itself. The U.S. Federal Reserve quickly stabilized the market through massive purchases of Treasury securities and through the extension of dollar swap lines to European central banks, which in turn restored dollar liquidity to their customers. The emergency actions were justified by the extraordinary circumstances of March of 2020. An external shock, namely the COVID-19 pandemic, upended financial markets, and the central bank acted responsibly in extending liquidity to the market. But the U.S. Federal Reserve and the Biden administration now propose to extend these emergency measures into a continuing flood of demand. The consequences will be dire. The present situation is unprecedented in another way as well. Not in the past century has the United States faced a competitor with an economy as big as ours, growing much faster than ours, in fact, with ambitions to displace us as the world's leading economic power. China believes that America's fiscal irresponsibility will undermine the dollar status as the world's reserve currency.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. One of the fundamental teachings of Islam, as we all know, is that of adl, of justice. And for those of us who have, you know, at least studied some of the basic aqaid or theology or Islamic beliefs, we know what justice means. That justice means that, you know, you put a particular thing in its right place, that a thing or whatever that thing may be is placed in its correct place in the correct manner. It is not, you know, you do not take shoes and you put shoes in the shoe rack. Rather, you put the shoes in the shoe rack and you don't put books in the shoe rack, and so on. And so this is an example that I given to children in the madrasas. You know, you put everything in its proper place. This is what justice means. So therefore, when it comes to morals and it comes to ethics, Islam also promotes this type of justice. That a person who is deserving of something should receive it, and a person who is not deserving should not receive. This is justice, this is equity. You know, we do not believe in equality. Equality and equity are two different things. Equity is giving something, or somebody rather, what they deserve. Equality is giving everybody the same, regardless if deserving or not. No, that's a different discussion altogether. So in this tradition from Imam Ali alayhi salam is speaking about how good manners and evil manners should be rewarded and punished. And it is not necessary for you to actually focus on the bad. And this again is a very beautiful tarbiyati or kind of self-development point that we as parents, as Muslims, as individuals can use, in not only in our homely lives but also at work, when we teach, etc., etc. So the Imam alayhi salam says this. He says, punish the wrongdoer. Now it doesn't say by whooping him, by throwing him out. No, none of that. Very simply, punish the wrongdoer by rewarding the good one. For when you reward the good one, the person who is wrong will understand that, oh, he's getting something. Hopefully, you know, you'd hope that the person who's in the wrong will say, oh, this person's getting rewarded, he's getting something good, he's getting praised. I also want that. In order for me to get that, I have to change my behavior. This is what normally should happen in a person. However, this is not always the case. Sometimes when you reward a good doer, the person who is a bad doer or a wrongdoer actually gets worse. And again, a different type of method should be used there. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to, you know, practice these teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam in our own family circles and hopefully into the larger community. And that we create a community that is worthy and ready for the coming of the Imam Ajjalallahu ta'ala Farajum Sharif, inshaAllah. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
The Spotlight.
Now, for the first time in decades, South Africa is calling up thousands of reservists to tackle a wave of looting and violence. Food, fuel, and medicine chains have been targeted. More than 110 people have been killed and thousands more arrested. Now, all this since former President Jacob Zuma started a 15-month jail term last week. Now, what has turned rallies into violent encounters and lootings in a matter of a week? And that's what we'll put on the spotlight.
South Africa has been in utter chaos since last Thursday, a day after former President Jacob Zuma handed himself into authorities to serve a 15-month jail term. Zuma was convicted of contempt of court after he defied an order to testify before a judicial commission probing allegations of fraud during his years in office. The former leader's imprisonment sparked protests across much of South Africa. The unrest soon escalated into mayhem. In the past 7 days, more than 800 retail shops and over 200 shopping malls have been looted. Government estimates suggest hundreds of millions of dollars of goods have been purloined or destroyed. That has sparked fears of a looming humanitarian crisis, with authorities warning that parts of South Africa may soon be running short of basic provisions. Analysts believe this could be a further blow to the nation's economy, already reeling from the coronavirus pandemic.
What could come out of this, of course, would be even further economic crises in South Africa. Amid this COVID-19 third wave, which has impacted South Africa more than any other country on the African continent.
The South African Army has already deployed thousands of troops to help overstretched police